Hello, I'm Kevin Williamson, a reporter and writer in residence here at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and this is How the World Works, a series of conversations about work. My guests and I talk about the jobs we have and the ones we have had, why work matters, the role of work in our economy and in our social life, and we discuss policy ideas for ways to help workers and employers get the most out of the work they do. One of our assumptions here is that work involves a lot more than hours put in and paychecks cashed. It's an integral part of our social life, part of how we learn to serve one another living in community. I hope you enjoy the conversations. If you have any ideas for guests or ideas about how to shape the conversation, send me an email at work@cei.org. Thanks. I'm here with an old friend, Veronique DeRougie. And one of my all-time favorite interviews was Chris Rock when he had a talk show. He had Jesse Jackson on, and he just asked him, he said, Reverend Jackson, what do you do? And in that case, it was kind of an eviscerating question because, you know, Jesse Jackson is not good at explaining what it is he actually does. But what do you do?
So I mean,
you tell people you work at a think tank and they think it's like a born identity.
Yeah, the top line is like I work for the Mercatus Center, which is a university based research center. But then what do I do there? Mm. Right. And by the way, what I do there is not exactly the same thing as some of my colleagues. Mm. We all do very different things. That's a reflection of the skills we have. So I write studies, but I also write columns. And the way I think about what I do is I am trying to defend a viewpoint and to try to explain to people why I believe the world would be better if my vision for the world was put in place.
Gotcha. I remember a long time ago when I was a young newspaper editor, and I met a guy who had this really nice, impressive house. And so I asked him, what do you do? And he said, you know what I do? I'm the president of thus and such bank.
I know what you do.
And I was like, yeah, but what do you actually do all day? So what is your day look like? What is a day in the life of a think tank writer and scholar actually consist of for the most
part? So it depends on the day for me, mm-hmm. because I'm a syndicated columnist. So on Mondays, usually I think about a column idea for the week and I write that column, right? So Mondays and part of Tuesdays and Wednesday mornings are devoted to that because then I send it to my editors and at Mercatus, and then we just have back and forth about sometime contents, but mostly about the flow and trying to kind of fact check some of the things I write, making sure that, because then it's sent to creators. Mm-hmm. But I also, as I said, I always have longer term project on the fire. So for instance, like right now I'm trying to write a case against industrial policy, but from a populist perspective to try to, because I've always long believed, and I'm not the only one, that when you're a classical liberal or a libertarian or in some cases a conservative, you're really ultimately a populist. For instance, when you fight against cronyism, so the unhealthy marriage, unhealthy, I call it unhealthy. I think it's profoundly unhealthy marriage between government and the private sector, right? The reason why you do it is for all the unseen victims. And often they're workers in other firms that are not subsidized. They are consumers who see higher prices in what they consume and things like this. And that is very profoundly populist at its core because it's fighting a government privilege to usually a very big company. So I'm trying to kind of show all the ways that actually industrial policy expresses itself in this favoritism to big companies. And that goes really profoundly against a populist approach to policy, which often the people who are pushing industrial policy are arguing they're doing this for. So that's kind of some of the stuff.
I'm sorry, you said that so persuasively, because usually anytime I find myself doing something that feels a little bit populist, I assume I'm wrong. And I try to walk away from it, but maybe.
But no, I mean, there's a lot of things that we do that at their core, we're really populist. We're thinking like, so for instance, like the case, there is a very populist case for a reduction of the corporate income tax, right? And that is that basically when you reduce the corporate income tax, economists have like found that a significant part of the reduction benefits workers in the form of higher wages. The reverse is true, is that when you increase the corporate income tax, people think corporations are the one paying the tax and they're not paying their fair share. But what effectively they do is that you withdraw, they basically, you as they have to write a check, right? Who is really shouldering the cost of that tax? And we know either through innovation, the lack of innovation because of the lack of capital that can be invested, or through the promotion of workers, either through economic growth, but also making them being more productive through innovation and technology. Basically, workers are the one shouldering the cost of the increase. Most of the cost, it goes between 25% to 100% is shouldered by workers, right? So there's, when you think about the reason why we fight for classical liberal ideas, I think very often at its core, it's a very populist case we can make.
Well, I want to get back to some policy stuff later in the conversation, mm-hmm. but kind of want to keep this about your job for the moment. What were you doing before you're doing what you're doing now?
Before Mercatus at GMU, I was at AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, doing roughly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was at the Cato Institute. And before that, I was at GMU finishing my dissertation and doing a postdoc.
So you've been in this pretty much all of your post-education life. Mm-hmm. Well, earlier in life, were you a taxi driver? Did you work as a waitress? Were you a bouncer at a nightclub in Paris?
No, I did a lot of babysitting.
Babysitting.
And then when I was in Paris and when I was in school, the first part of my PhD, but also I started when I was in my last year doing my master's, I was working for IHS Europe. So basically what we did, we were organizing summer seminars for European students. And it was actually really cool because it was at the beginning of the 90s. And a lot of the kids we were getting, let's say we would have a 1 week seminar in Oxford, England, and we would get a lot of kids from Romania, from Hungary, from all these places that were actually escaping communism. And it was really pretty. It was quite inspiring. Mm-hmm.
So never had a real job then, basically.
Never had a real job. Gotcha. Yes. So I guess that's a way to mask the fact that I never had one and never wanted to have one.
Well, it's kind of interesting the way that the work has evolved in our time, because a lot of good jobs, in fact, are things that don't really feel like work, or as most people think of work. Like, you know, when I was younger, I had non-glamorous jobs. You know, I worked at Burger King, I worked at 7-Eleven, things like that.
I was a babysitter a lot.
Yeah, I'm currently a full-time babysitter, but it's mine. So that's it's not really a paying proposition.
Oh, believe me, you'll be paying a lot as a parent.
Yeah, there actually are a lot of jobs I think that are sort of difficult for people to really explain. So like I'm a fairly easy one because I just write, you know. So and sometimes I do conversations like this, but people. So what do you do? Well, I write magazine articles and newspaper columns and books. And so that's pretty straightforward. But like, I have a lot of friends who are consultants at McKinsey and places. I don't know what they do. I don't know what they actually do all day. I try to get them to explain it to me, and it always sounds like they're just making it up as they go.
But they're trying to solve problems, right? They're hired by clients who have a problem, and they're trying to kind of give them a path away from that problem. Yeah. So using different tools. The father of my children worked at McKinsey for a long time. Mm-hmm. And effectively what they were doing is like they were trying to solve businesses' problems. So in different industries, they're like, there's even one in McKinsey even has a specialty for nonprofits. Yeah. Nonprofit, like not like, you know, the ones you've been in or the one I've been in, mm-hmm. but, you know, like bigger nonprofits.
Well, I guess our careers actually did overlap somewhat in the nonprofit world when I was at IHS while you were at Mercatus. So I guess we did work at the same place for a while.
Well, and then
at National Review.
National Review, because I still blog there. Not a lot. This is the interesting thing about my life and my work life is like there are times where I feel the best thing I can do is to actually blog and then talk to people through that medium, which I think is always a very good medium. And there are very interesting conversations that are taking place there. When I discover a new area of interest, I write a lot of papers, mm-hmm. and it's my way of like thinking through a lot of these problems. That said, I sometimes do this in the blogging area. So it depends on the battles I'm waging or the barricade I'm on.
At what point in life did you become comfortable enough with English to write professionally?
I'd say that early. Sometimes I'm still not.
Still trouble.
Sometimes I'm still not, right? I always think when I give talks and I am asked to give professional advice to people, I always say I would advise against doing what I did, which is to enter a field where the main skill you need is the command of a language. Because when I was younger, people thought, oh, it's cute. Like she has a French accent and all this, you know, it's cute. But the truth of the matter is like in most times, it's not even an advantage. Mm. Because as you start aging, when you, for instance, you go on TV, it doesn't really matter that you have a cute accent. If people can't understand what you're saying, you know, they're not going to invite you back. Right. And for the writing, it's never completely, natural. But that said, I wasn't a great writer in French either. Mm. And so that's the big tragedy of my life, which is like, basically, I'm not 100% comfortable in any languages, but to some extent that I'm more comfortable in one is English, strangely, mm-hmm. because it's a language that fits me better.
That's interesting. How?
I think there's a directness about English that I like, a lack of, you don't have to... When I go to France and I listen to people talk, especially on TV, I'm always thinking there's something kind of vaguely fake about the way they talk.
It's very clever language.
Yes, it's clever language and it's pretty. And I'm not clever this way. But
so you write in English, then, you know, sometimes write in French and then translate.
In fact, when a lot of people have asked me, why don't you also kind of have a presence in France? And this is because I just can't write in French. Well, and people have also said, would you give a talk in French? And I would be like, I'd rather not, because I think in English, I think especially with professional issues, the language I've developed over the years is English. Yeah. And so there's just limitation, which is why I say it's kind of like sad because it's not as if I don't make mistakes in English but then I can say, well, it's because I'm so good in French.
Well, as someone who was an editor for most of his career, most native English speakers aren't very good at English either. So it's okay.
But so I think it's just because I put way more efforts in what I write, I think, because of that, because I'm constantly trying to overcome.
Did you ever think about taking a different path in life? Is there a sort of road not taken for you professionally, a job you would have done if you weren't doing the thing you're doing now?
So when I was ready to leave Cato, I was offered a job at the Joint Economic Committee and I didn't go.
So what's the Joint Economic
Committee? It's a Joint Committee. It's like it serves both sides of Congress. Mm-hmm. And it just basically depending on who's in the majority, right? It writes reports and informs Congress on a bunch of issues. And these issues vary depending on who's the head of the committee at the time. So when Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, was the head of the committee a few years ago, right, they developed a whole programs of thinking about social capital and things like this. And like right now, I think they're writing a report. The Joint Economic Committee always write reports on a bunch of economic issues depending. And I know there's one that's going to come out in August. And it's always interesting because it's basically like a bunch of economists and non-economists thinking about kind of bigger issues. And so it's always, whether I agree with them or not, it's always worth a read, right? And so I didn't do this because I was just the idea of working for the government was just, ugh, no, not possible.
So you never really had any ideas for career paths that aren't about economics?
But no, not really. But that sometimes I wonder whether it's a mistake in a way you, and in the same way as having, I think having worked in the private sector, maybe in a company, and there's just like a lot of the times, right? When I read about financial markets and there's a big difference between the way economists think about financial markets and about the way people live working for for companies. And so sometimes I wonder whether, you know, I'm missing something. I could have been much better had I had experience about what it's like to be inside government or what it's like to be in the private sector.
Yeah.
But
well, maybe in some future episodes, I'll be able to help you out with that and get some people on who can explain. It is very different to be an economist in an academic sense or a bond trader. You know, and bond traders and commodities traders have a very different, you know, interaction with the market than someone who's looking at it.
When I'm on TV often, they ask me, like, they'll ask me about the market and I'll be like, I don't.
Haven't looked at my IRA in six months.
Well, but it's also like, I kind of like the economy is not the market and the market is, I mean, it is, but it's like, it's very different, right? The market goes up and down based on things very often that I think is just stupid. Like they respond positively to policies that I think are just incredibly stupid, right? And so like the announcement of a stimulus bill, like, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars and the market goes up in flames.
Yeah.
And so it's...
Up in flames in a good way, you mean?
Well, I mean, it goes up, let's say. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it will go up in flames. But so it's just kind of sometimes I wish I had a kind of somewhat of a better understanding at a pure functional kind of, but no, I never really thought about, you know, becoming a vet or, I mean, except when I was like a little kid or.
But you thought you could work on unicorns.
You know, no, unicorns were never my thing.
No,
you know, it's just in France, we just didn't have those.
No unicorns in your part of France?
No, not really.
That's very sad. Some questions about other workers that I thought I would bring up. One of the things that seems to me is that in our policy conversations, we spend a lot of time worrying about the wrong workers and the wrong people, I think, in general. So we've just gone through this national convulsion and Supreme Court case about admissions practices at Harvard. And I care about the case and I care about the issues that are involved in the case, but I don't care that much about the people in the case, honestly, because the people who are kind of on the cusp of getting into Harvard and who may be advantaged by their policy or maybe slightly disadvantaged by their policy, their worst case scenario is they go to Stanford instead or something, or maybe the University of Texas if they're really, really unlucky. Those people are going to be fine in life. The people who really have trouble, I think, in our labor market, in our economy, and in our society, are not people who are like, yeah, maybe you get into Harvard, maybe you won't. They're people who are not applying to Harvard. You know, they're people who often haven't graduated from high school, or certainly aren't pointing themselves in that direction. And I think part of that is the fact that the policymaking conversation, of course, is now I'm going to flirt with that populism I didn't want to get into, but it's dominated by people like us. So you have a PhD in economics from you went to the Sorbonne, right? Mm-hmm. And I am not that educated, so I can be a good populist in that sense.
Sorbonne, so people don't understand about France is like, it's University of Paris is different parts.
Right. This is some uncut populism right here.
Yeah, exactly. So where I went was like, for my PhD was the Pantheon Sorbonne part. Mm-hmm. And there's a Sorbonne part, and which Americans strangely think about as something that's great. It may have been great centuries ago. It's just
we think of it as being French for Oxford.
Yeah. I wish it were, but
it sounds pretty fancy anyway. But, you know, we're the kind of people who really dominate the conversation, and people who write for the New York Times and Washington Post and places like that, they care a lot about the admissions policies at elite universities because that's their world. That's where their kids are going to go. It's where they went. And that's, you know, sort of my world in a way, too. The bigger problem we have economically, I think, and socially in terms of social mobility and in terms of getting people connected with productive, useful, rewarding work isn't the kids who have to go to Stanford instead of going to Harvard, but that's not nearly as big a part of the conversation. So
that's it. I mean, I think their bigger problem, even from a populist perspective, with the way that case was ruled, I actually think it was still, correct. I mean, just from a matter of principle that we should not be discriminating. And besides, what's bothered me about the whole thing is the justification for affirmative action is right. It's like it comes from a world where America was mostly white and black, right? And there were some real problems. There were some real structural things that was holding back black people. But here, in effect, you're pitting, black people versus Asian people, while at the same time preserving the stuff like legacy. And all of that stuff. So it's.
And more specifically, you're pitting the typically well-educated children of high-income black families versus the well-educated children of high-income Asian families.
So I think it was a good thing to remind people that just kind of it's a problematic proposition that affirmative action, while may come from a place that may have made sense. This is not my area of expertise, but and that kind of discriminating like Harvard was doing in a way that was kind of really really just problematic. That's a problem. But I also and the Supreme Court couldn't do anything about the fact that this was still happening in a context again where there was just a lot of leg up that remained in the admission process that were given again to legacy and athletes and so I think that kind of like if we want to really say that we are in a country that has an admission process that's based on merit, that's based on all sorts of criteria that we like, I think we need to kind of level up this whole thing. That's what bothered me about the whole thing. And the Supreme Court, again, can only, answer what it is asked to answer. But yeah, I agree with you. The country is like really focused on a lot of issues that are like very class related. They want to make it as if somehow this is really what matters for the entire country and for those who are struggling.
Yeah. Give me an example of what I mean about sort of changing the conversation. We don't like occupational licensing very much, either one of us. But one thing I'll say in the defense of occupational licensing is that it creates a point of focus and a path for entering a profession. So you or I could walk out of this building and grab anyone off the street and say, how do you become a lawyer? And they'll say, well, you go to college and you go to law school, then you get your, you pass the bar and you join a law firm and then you're a lawyer and you have a license to practice law. But if you try to ask someone, well, how do you become a diesel mechanic? Or how do you, take up any of these other skilled blue collar occupations? People don't know. And that is enormously consequential, I think, for young people trying to enter the marketplace. So you've got a lot of people who are 15, 16, 17 years old, a lot of male, who are not going to go to college and not going to become McKinsey consultants and not going to get MBAs or PhDs. There's nothing wrong with that. And they're not going to college because they're dumb, or because they're not educable, because it's just not their interest. They're not academically inclined. It's not what they want to do with their lives. But they don't have a thing they can sit and say, well, here's what I want to do in life. And here are the three things I have to do to make that happen. The way someone who's going to become a lawyer has those things in front of them.
Yeah, but don't you think, though, that's the problem? The problem is actually there's a myth that persists. And if you go to college, you're going to be better off.
Right.
Right. And for a long time, it was the data show that it was the case, right? And that has become the base for a lot of the policies that were designed. And that has affected also the culture where basically a lot of energy is spent thinking you have to go to college. When in reality, right, considering the cost of college, if depending on the major you follows, that idea that if you go to a four-year college, you're going to make more money, you're going to be better off, isn't true anymore for everyone. Right. And in fact, people would have been better off doing something else. But that kind of really that prevalent belief has actually probably done a disservice, because there are few people who are willing to say, you know what, I don't want to go to college. What I'd like to be is a plumber. And by the way, you'll make a lot of money being plumber, since there are so few people who take that route. Mm-hmm. And you can make a lot of money being a plumber, at least, I don't know, but in Arlington, they seem to be doing very well.
But it's sort of a huge check to movers.
Yeah. But even I think there are just a lot of schools decided that, you know, it was just like not worth even offering this, because very few people would pick up on it.
Yeah, I think it is fundamentally a cultural problem, not a policy problem. I think there may be some policy things that could be done, and maybe we'll talk about those in a minute, but I think it starts off as a cultural problem. You know, I was talking about helping people find paths for things. There was a guy I knew I went to high school with who, you know, smart, energetic guy, but wasn't going to college. And his family had an auto body business, and he was really interested in cars. And so he went to work for the family business, ended up taking it over, did really well in life, made a ton of money, started making it when he was 18, you know, 19 years old, you know, got married young, had kids young, all that stuff, a good way of living, and one that satisfied his particular interests and values and needs. But people look at him and say, he's so smart and hardworking. Think of what he could have done with his life if he'd gone to college. And of course, it probably wouldn't have worked out nearly as well. You know, some years ago, I was interviewing, Jesse James, the motorcycle customizer. And when he was really big in his television show back then. And I thought, how weird is it that guys who, you know, go to college and they play with spreadsheets all day and they make $65,000 or $80,000 a year, and they go home and they spend their evenings watching television shows about this guy who's a welder and makes $10 million a year. But we still look down on those occupations in a lot of way, and on occupations that don't require a professional license, that don't require a graduate degree or a four-year degree.
Well, I mean, like, when you say we.
I think we as a society. I don't mean you and me.
Yeah, no, because I was going to say, I think that it's more likely that it's a parent in Arlington, where the kids come and say, oh, you know what? I don't want to go to college, because what I want to do is I want to be a plumber. I want to be a welder. Mm-hmm. I want to be in the auto car repair, whatever. Those parents are going to be like horrified, right? But I assume that in most places in the country, I mean, parents are going to be like, okay. But where you are right, I think, is like the problem is that newspapers and universities and a lot of the opinion makers, right? They would look down. They would think it's a weird choice. It's a wrong choice. And why aren't they going to college? That's the problem. But I think there's this big disconnect between what people think around here versus the rest of the country. And unfortunately, the people around here and what they think is highly influential in directing policies and just influencing the culture.
Yeah, there's a lack of knowledge and a lack of information, I think, and a lack of insight about, or particularly about, you know, how well certain kinds of jobs pay. I had a friend who was working construction and went to work one day and was wearing a Rolex, and suddenly got very self-conscious about it and took it off and put it away so as not to, you know, look like he's flaunting, you know, in front of these workers. And then listening to the workers talk about, you know, the ATVs they were buying, and which cost more than the stupid watch did, and thinking, you know, it's a different economy than the one I thought it was. That the people who are actually really good at construction aren't, they're not making $10 an hour. They're not making minimum wage. They have, you know, it's a good job. It's enough to support a family. It's a stable kind of life for a lot of people. And it's work that people enjoy doing. And then when they're done at the end of the day, they feel like they've done something.
Yeah.
But again, I have in my head this, you know, this sort of archetypal, you know, 15, 16 year old boy I think about a lot. And how do we get him, if he's, you know, not going to go to Princeton and not going to go to law school and not going to do something like that, how do we get him at that point to understand there are things you can do in life that'll pay you pretty well? Sometimes it'll pay you really well, that'll give you a life that you'll like, that you'll enjoy, that you'll find rewarding, and allow you to have, you know, a family and a place in society and a kind of, you know, status in your community and these sorts of things. But there are things you have to do to get from where you are to that place. And honestly, a lot of times, you know, if I sat down with that kid myself, I could probably give him some reasonably good advice on things. But, you know, even as someone who thinks about this stuff a lot and writes about this stuff a lot, I'm not sure I would do a very good job of explaining to a lot of people, particularly, you know, kids in communities that are radically different from mine, with very different backgrounds, what they would have to do and what the possibilities actually are.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the path exists. If you feel when you're in high school that what you want to do is some more manual jobs, and I don't know how it works. I'll admit, I have no clue. And I think the problem comes also, I mean, much before this. So while there is a path or not, which I may not know, that's one problem. But also, like, when you're in school, there's this expectation that you'll go to all the way to the end of high school, right? And what is valued in high school, in school in general, is a path that delivers you to a university. Mm-hmm. And so I think kind of the problem is there, leaving aside the problem of the quality of schools, right? And the engagement of teachers. And I think it's just kind of like there is this expectation that when you do K to 12, where you're meant to be delivered into that university system further mm-hmm. down the road. There's no off ramp from this, right? And so, and usually when there's an off ramp, usually it's because you're such a troubled kid that they want to just kind of push you away and, you know, get rid of you, which is not, it's not a solution either. Right. So
the off ramp's not a job.
Yeah. You know? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people who think about it. There's something to be said about how just really constrained, structured, and limiting our school systems, our school system is.
I think we overreacted to the perceived problem of tracking. You know, so in earlier generations, you know, 1950s, 1960s, there was a habit of, you know, pushing certain kids into a kind of college path and other kids into a kind of go get a job at a factory path. And this was often done in a way that was unfair and biased and all the usual problems you would expect out of something like that. That being said, tracks are useful things to have, assuming that you can do this in the right way. So in overcorrecting for that, we sort of made this assumption that the model for everyone is pre-college education. And then the path for everyone is to a university campus and then something else after that. And we haven't really entirely gotten rid of vocational education and job training in schools and things like that. We still do some of that, maybe not as much as we should and not as well as we should. It's always struck me, by the way, that is one of the places in society in which labor unions could and should play a really useful role is in developing those sorts of programs.
But the labor, I mean, they're... Yeah, I don't know. But like the laborers in school, for instance, labor unions in school, they're focused on the teachers. They're not focused on the kids.
No, I didn't mean the I didn't mean the teachers' unions. I meant the other ones.
I agree, but I think even them are becoming elites, right?
The labor unions have become elites.
But I think that one of the problem is that government does not adjust well, and schools are the governmental system, and so the flexibility to adjust to actually a need for each of the student is just, it doesn't exist. It's like, it's a system that they, I mean, call it the school system. It has a path. And if that path doesn't work, it's just not good at changing and evolving. And there are just so many kind of special interests that are, that don't want to do things differently. And that may be a real problem.
Yeah.
And it's, what's interesting is, like, I've read a bunch of things about how some companies at least are starting to understand that you're better off training your own employees. So they're hiring people straight out of high school and to start training them. And then within to actually fit. Like Moulinex was doing this. I'd read this a few years ago, and they were getting high school kids and they were training them to actually fit their real needs. Because when you think about it, so 40% straight out of college, kids don't actually get a job in the major they followed when they were in college. It's a little less than this. It's 25% later down the road, but it's still a pretty big system that there's a real mismatch. So those companies will train kids straight out of high school, make them like the kind of employees they need. And then along the way, they can retrain them for different jobs. Right? That seems to be like a response to a university system that has kind of overtaken the whole post K-12 education and is not delivering for what firms want.
Yeah, that's how I got into journalism. I got out of school and the poetry companies just weren't hiring. And so you had to do something else. But it is a different job market, I think, for skilled blue collar workers than it was not very long ago. So, you know, 15 years ago, I would drive around out in, you know, West Texas or Pennsylvania in the kind of oil and gas country, and you would hear radio commercials that said, "Do you have a commercial driver's license? If you do, call us up, come to work for our oil and gas company. We'll pay you $100,000 a year to drive a truck." And the commercials now say, "Are you eligible to get a commercial driver's license? Call us up. We'll put you through the CDL program, and then we'll hire you and give you the job."
So what does that mean?
It means that there's a real demand for people with commercial driver's licenses, I think, to work in energy.
Yeah.
Or at least there has been at times. And it's an infamously fickle business that demand for labor comes and goes. Are there things we can do policy-wise, you think, that would help to improve the situation for those kinds of entrants into the labor force?
So I think kind of fixing the school system is one of them. Like there are so many.
In the realm of things that might actually happen, do you have any idea?
In the realm that might happen, I don't know. I mean, the problem is like a lot of the adjustment.
What would you change in the school system though?
I don't know. I just would make it more flexible. I give more have more competition, allow kids to be able to take their money and go to other form of education if they need to, just not have like school choice. It's an important path to allow kids to have an education that fits them better. But I also think that maybe we need to get out of this idea that every kid needs to go to the kind of schools. Even charter schools are kind of like, you know, a same model than the public schools or private schools. And maybe there is actually kind of a model of education that looks radically different. And that won't happen as long as basically there's no way for people to experiment and to really try different for kids to be able to. School choice, I think, can be a way not just to empower charter schools, but maybe to try things that look very, very different. And I don't know what those are. And I don't know. But so on the school front, I think there's a lot of things to do. But I think on the labor market front, I mean, removing a lot of the barriers that exist from people to be able to adjust and find the kind of jobs that fits them. And that goes from, you know, getting rid of a lot of the occupational licensing, minimum wage, which you know, kind of basically dictate the relationship between worker and employers that we have, but also like, you know, zoning laws and land use, I think do a lot of damage to actually the mobility, the ability of people in low wage, high unemployment areas to actually move to other place and get access to a better labor market with a higher wage premium, because it's not worth moving if basically the cost of housing is going to take away all or more than the difference in wage that you can get. So there's just a lot of the problem that we see for workers that are stuck in less than economically vibrant areas that are the product of government barriers that are erected everywhere. Things like this, creating some flexibility and ability and give workers ability to move.
I've often thought that maybe repackaging unemployment benefits as relocation benefits for people would be helpful in some cases anyway, and making them more generous than we have. Another thing that, you know, I've kind of come around to in life, surprising to myself, there is a case to be made, I think, for more corporate paternalism toward workers in terms of going out, recruiting people from distant areas, helping them relocate, helping them get their lives organized in a new place. You know, my grandfather worked for Phillips Petroleum, and he lived in a town called Phillips, Texas. And Phillips was a company town, as you might imagine. I don't think it was ever actually incorporated as a formal city or anything like that. The company really did run things in ways that were both, I suppose, positive and negative. But when I talk to people I know from that area and that community who had lived there and worked for the company and all that, they loved living in a company town because it helped them to organize their lives in certain kinds of way, help them organize their kids' lives. So I'm not advocating Amazon City be built somewhere, although I suppose that's kind of what the Bay Area has become in many ways and some other places, but of maybe giving businesses some tools to help them be the ones who deliver certain kinds of social services related to relocation, connecting with jobs and things like that to the people who need them. Because having sort of government agencies in there don't have a very good history of getting it done. You know, every kind of government-driven jobs training program that's ever been created has been a failure. Essentially, they don't have a really very good track record. But businesses have, as you alluded to earlier, a pretty good idea of what it is they actually need, but they don't have a lot of incentives to be maybe as aggressive and creative as they could be when it comes to recruiting and developing new workers, relocating workers especially. And maybe they don't have
all the training workers. Yeah. Actually, the tax code, if you want to make an investment in your workers, my understanding is that there's no way to deduct these costs in the same way as you would deduct other labor costs. So that's something that could be changed. So that would give an incentive, a better incentive for companies to really invest in their workers and train them in the way that that they ought to be trained. But think about it, like the government's omnipresence in a lot of areas, whether it's the deliverance of benefits, whether it's like unemployment, right, has actually devastated a lot of private companies that used to deliver these services. And that were, these were much more portable benefits than we used to have. There's a real tragedy about the fact that some design in the tax codes means that there's just a lot of incentives for, I mean, the system, the healthcare system is designed effectively the insurance system is designed to be provided through companies with workers really having very little say. And if you step outside of the system, this is what Obamacare was really about. It was like, how do we cater in the context of where most workers are getting their insurance through their employers? How do we cater to those few that are not in that system, right? How do we, and unfortunately, this is true. It's just the government gives incentives, which then end up shaping the entire market, right? And even in a way where most of healthcare, I think, should be paid for with people's own money, not by a third party.
The way we pay for everything else.
Yeah. But that's not the case, right? The whole system is designed in a way where that kind of consumer choice is taken away. Like there's expectation that someone else is going to shoulder the cost of your healthcare. That then itself, like raise prices, blah, 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 and all. So this is the problem, is like the government is everywhere and every aspect, like job training, right? There's if the taxpayers are going to be, what is paying for it? And there's what's the incentive for companies to do it?
I've always thought that employer-based healthcare was one of the worst policies that we ever kind of came up with, although we came up with it by accident, partly because it's a bad way to deliver health insurance, but also because I think it really deepened this sense of relying on a single employer for, or maybe two employers for all of your life, and that having a job with a big company is going to be the thing that solves your problems in life.
And you know, it's the biggest, what we call tax expenditure, which is basically like it's a tax break. it's the biggest one. It's extremely expensive. It's very, very distortive, and it affects the labor, the healthcare market in so many ways. And getting rid of this would be, you know, would be great. But
well, one of the reasons it stands out to me is because I think one of the unacknowledged issues in economic life in the United States is that there are really radically different levels of risk aversion among different people across our society and among different social groups. So, you know, a kind of modern globalized economy where you're changing jobs a lot, where maybe you don't even have a regular job, or you're going from one deal to the next and one thing to the next, is really, really appealing to a certain kind of person. For other people, that sounds just like hell on earth because, you know, nothing's ever settled, nothing's ever stable. And I mean, there are people who are kind of, you know, sort of more naturally entrepreneurial. There are people who are more naturally inclined to want to have a job in an organization where they can stay. Our policymaking people tend to be the people who are from the more risk positive kind of world because they're wealthier, they're better educated, they're more flexible, they're more mobile. And the people that they're trying to help tend to have a much higher level, I think, of risk aversion. I mean, that's really what the Obamacare debate ended up being about was, I mean, the unacknowledged part of that debate was, well, yes, this healthcare system may be less effective and more expensive than it would have been otherwise based on if we had a more market-based system, but it'll be predictable and you'll never lose your insurance unexpectedly and there won't be unexpected expenses that'll land on you, or you won't suddenly find out that a procedure's not covered. Now, granted, those were not promises that were kept, but that was kind of the marketing for it.
But again,
and I think a lot of people look at that and they make a rational decision to say, I'll take the slightly inferior but more stable and reliable and predictable system over the better, riskier one.
Yeah, but at the same time, right? I mean, I think kind of the risk aversion of the elites is very palpable, right? They want a system where someone else is paying the tab. And sure, yeah. Right? And they're the ones who are employed in those companies that actually provide healthcare. They're imposing their risk aversion on everyone else. If you listen to a lot of the ways the policy debates are taking place these days, and I assume it was always the case, it's always like, how do we make any risk disappear? And of course, we know that's just not possible. But a lot of what drives policy, whether you take paid leave, for instance, it's like, it's like, why is it that not everyone benefits from paid leave? Like it would be so much better if everyone, that's the elite imposing their preference on everyone else. But, you know, what is true for healthcare is true for paid leave, which is that when a company delivers, like pays for a benefit, right? It means automatically that your wage, the money you're going to take home, is going to be lower. Right? It means that it changes the mix that your total compensation is made of. Mm-hmm. And different workers have different preferences of what that mix should look like. Some people would prefer to have just all the money in cash, you know, and others, they prefer, they're more risk averse and they prefer to be totally covered. But no one ever talks about that, right? About the fact that there are people who are willing to get more in cash and then deal when the time comes, rather than actually have a mix of wage versus benefit imposed on them by people who think that everyone should be covered in this way, that no one should be left to actually kind of face or prepare for something like this. Because that's one of the like things that I find the most frustrating in the way we talk about like wages and wage growth and things like this. Like people are always saying like wages are not growing as fast as they should. But actually, when you look at total compensation, it's keeping up with productivity, except that people who are thinking that they're not, they're just looking at wages. But today, a third on average of total compensation, which is really the cost that an employer is facing for their employees, is like, it's actually growing. A third of that is the fringe benefits, whether it's like, and that to me, again, is something that's removing a big part of the flexibility, imposing it. And I think that's the reverse. I think it's the very risk averse elites who think that everyone, everyone should be covered in the most expensive way.
Yeah, or maybe it's that they aren't actually risk averse for themselves, but they're risk averse on behalf of people they think can't really be trusted to make their own decisions in the marketplace.
But are they like,
because when you bring up, you know, things about school choice or having market-based solutions for health insurance, it's, well, that's great for people like us, but these people, if you let them make their own decisions about schools, they'll send their kids to these crazy religious schools where they'll be taught about, you know, creationism. And if you expect them to buy their own health insurance, they'll just take the money and they'll buy lottery tickets or something else. I mean, they don't speak about it in those explicitly condescending terms, but it seems to me that's
some people do. Yes. Right. I mean, like, remember the debate about universal basic income?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, the way the left was talking about being opposed to it was no. You don't understand. We can't give cash to people because some people are not gonna, they're not gonna spend it wisely. So it's much better to have this horrible welfare paternalistic system that allocates that much money to food, that much money to housing, that much money to this and that and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, kind of, I mean, as a libertarian, it was always like, actually the appeal, not that I'm fully at all on board of, I mean, I'm not for universal basic income for a variety of reasons, but the appeal, the real appeal to me to actually a cash system is that you shouldn't be making that assumption that we know what is good for lower income people.
Yeah.
We just shouldn't, because some days the rent is harder to pay. Someday you have an emergency, your kid needs like, and to go to the dentist. Sometimes they need a, you know, and it just like, you know, things change. But I think the elites are unbelievably risk averse and paternalistic, and they want to impose, I'll happily say, it's like, we have no clue what it's like to live a life that's different than ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of want to control this and by kind of saying everyone should be living like we do. And that kind of, it really bothers me. And again, in a lot of these conversations, right, it's like, what we forget is like, the conversation shouldn't just be, who's going to be paying for your healthcare? Like, is it going to be the government or is it going to be an insurance? It actually should be, shouldn't we be paying for our healthcare, at least most of it, right? It's like that part of the conversation has totally disappeared, where like, I think CBO, the last data I saw, I don't know that it's not entirely updated, but if it's outdated, I assume this number that I'm going to give you is too high. It's like only 11% of the healthcare we pay out of pocket,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's something to me that is extremely distortive, is all those healthcare decisions are made either by the government coverage or by insurance coverage. Mm. There's rationing that's happening, and that rationing was not always bad, right? But what it means is that it really restrain your choice and what you can do. And it also prevents actually different innovations from different things from happening. And that's, as much as I love the school choice movement, right? I wonder whether an effectively, what it's doing is cementing a system that looks very much just like the public choice system, with more choice, obviously. And that's a good thing. But it's like, in the end, can K-12 look radically different? And I think in a system, again, a voucher system, it's still for options that are very much looking like, you know.
Yeah, I've often thought the problem with our education system is the idea of an education system, or even three or four education systems, which just aren't enough for a country as large and diverse and dynamic as ours. We need hundreds of models of education.
And again, I mean, I think school choice, I mean, I always kind of assess policies, whether it's more freedom, choice, you know, and innovation enhancing, and having school choice definitely beats the current system in the same way as a cash welfare is much better than the paternalistic system we have now that is not even serving. And because the eligibility have increased, it's really not serving those who really truly needed the most. Well, so it's a step in the right direction, but can we not stop there and just be much more radical?
Yeah. You know, you used a phrase earlier that you don't hear very much anymore, which is fringe benefits. I think people have stopped calling them that. They just call them, you know, sort of benefits. Although it was a very common expression when I was a kid growing up in the 70s. And I don't remember how old I was when I figured it out. But when I first heard that expression, what I heard was French benefits.
French, well, yeah.
And I was, what, is this something we borrowed from the French model or something? And at some point, it occurred to me that it was fringe. And
you're right, fringe. That it's not when a third of compensation.
It's not fringe anymore,
it's
no.
It's not fringe anymore.
Yeah.
And the reason why, you know, employers are all in for this is that they get this, there's the tax code favored them to deliver this, you know, more of the compensation in the form of benefits. And I think it's a big problem, especially if people are worried or concerned about wage growth. But we don't understand that that's a big part of what's constraining, especially a big chunk of that third of compensation delivered in the form of fringe benefits, mm-hmm. Is healthcare. And as healthcare costs go up, right, it's just starting to consume more and more. Mm-hmm. And so.
So as we get ready to close the conversation, I wanted to ask you one last question about your particular work. And a lot of jobs have really built-in metrics. You know, if you're a salesperson, you can measure your sales. If you are building cars, you can count how many cars you built or how many fenders you bolted on this week. How do you know when you've done a good job in your work? We all have deliverables, in, as they call them, because everyone talks to McKinsey consultants, and now we all talk about McKinsey consultants and say deliverables. But how do you know when you've done something right, when you've been effective in your job? Because affecting social change and political change is a very, very slow moving thing. Well, you take an issue like abortion, which was very, very, you know, and is still very charged. You know, there are thousands of people employed full time working on this issue, and it took, you know, 50 years to change one court decision. Most people don't have 50-year careers of working on one issue or one or two issues. So I'm filibustering a little bit here to give you time to think. So how do you know when you've you got the job done?
It's an important question that most people don't ask. And to some extent, I'm the beneficiary of those questions not being asked. it's really hard to know when you've affected social change, right? And because you can't, how do you follow the path of an idea? It's hard, and like, or how influential your work has been on a given outcome. And the problem with measuring things, right, is like you can only measure what you can measure. You can't really measure influence on this, I mean, with just rare occasions. So there, the reason why I say I'm a beneficiary of it is like when think tanks measure output, right, they're like, I'm fairly productive. I put out a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. And so I benefit from that, but it's also, thank God they don't like say, okay, you work on spending issues. Let's look at how successful you've been in reducing government spending. Because when I started at the Cato Institute, the federal government was spending roughly $1.8 trillion. And now I'm always amazed I still have a job, right? Because right. We're spending above $6 trillion, we're like we're $32 trillion in debt. We're heading to 200% of debt to GDP in debt in 30 years.
And so you're fired, obviously.
Yeah, so obviously I'm fired. But I mean, there are moments in my career where, and they're just, I can only think of two, where I've actually been able to see an outcome of what I've done. Like, so my fight on the Export-Import Bank, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yep. That's like, and I was really, because when I take on something, I'm like very fiery about it. And like, and you were at National Review at the time. That's all I was writing about.
I edited a lot of those pieces.
That's all I was writing about. I was just very fired up about it. And then it just, the charter was not renewed. And then 5 months later it was, but then there was no quorum. So basically for 4 years, the bank was really pretty much debilitated with functioning at 15% of its potential, which then allowed me to actually look at kind of what the export market looked like, what the the commercial lending market was like for exporters when it was closed, what those companies that are the big beneficiaries of XM, how they were faring, and everyone was doing very, very, very well. So
you're the Andrew Jackson of the Export Import Bank.
Yes, like maybe, but except that it's amazing how quick, you know, like politicians are so lame and unprincipled that, like, as committed as they were against cronyism, now they seem to have fully embraced it and, you know, and say that it's totally okay. And I just don't know who would fight with me that fight again. And then the other one was a border adjustment tax, right? XM was a partial success, but the border adjustment tax is something that I fought really, really, really hard. And that just did not happen. It was if you don't remember, it's like during the Trump preparation for the Trump tax cuts, right? They were considering a border adjustment tax, and a lot of people thought that was a great idea, and I was very opposed to it, but it's hard, like it's hard, and the problem is, like, so for instance, like right now, I've realized one of the things I've really dropped the ball on during all these years is like kind of the importance of economic growth, the importance of actually talking about abundance, which comes from allowing freeing suppliers to be as innovative and to provide as much of something, whether it's housing, energy, all sorts of things like free trade, like free. I'm not talking about this as the concept, but just like allow more trade. That ultimately creates growth, and the importance of growth and abundance is something I've forgot to think about as I was kind of really fighting these very discrete battles, as opposed to kind of remind people that there's nothing that double, right, the GDP per capita as growth does, but also kind of the disaster of not having economic growth. It's not just the loss of wealth, but it's the tribalism that come, the intolerance, all sorts of things, which I think we're living through right now, because the U.S. hasn't been growing as it should have probably for 20 years.
The social cost of economic unhappiness, you're saying?
Yeah, of economic, there's a morality of economic growth that economists don't talk about enough. And I'm kind of trying to kind of redirect a lot of what I do and try to think about these much broader issue to remind people, how do you see if it was working? I think there is a moment right now where more people are talking about this. If we start seeing the American people demanding more abundance, more growth, more, then we'll know that kind of somehow the fight we've taken on has worked. But it's just really hard to measure the influence we have. And the danger is to think that the number of retweet or the number of articles you write or the people who think you're great is a statement about how much value you add. And I think it's not. I think it's not, but it's intoxicating for some.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think this is why I actually like, in a way, to be reminded that ultimately we are populist, because we have to be thinking about taking on battles that actually matters to people who are the unseen victims of a lot of the bad government interventions. And taking those battles on, whether it's to free the energy market, which I think is a big important thing to do, because the ramification across all industries is extremely important, and economic growth and productivity is really important, or freeing all sorts of areas that will be more beneficial than even, you know, closing XM and just punishing like those big corporations who have government subsidies in their business model. And I think this is a service that the populace have given us, the true populace. It's like it's kind of reframing and forcing us to think about honestly, people we haven't thought about enough.
Yeah. And, yeah, measuring influence, of course, is notoriously difficult to do. And I was thinking that, you know, Rick Unger, he's a progressive activist and writer, he mentioned in some public forum one time that an article of mine had changed his mind about fracking. And he'd become sort of more open and friendly toward fracking. As far as I know, he's the only person whose mind I've ever changed on any issue of any real importance. No,
I actually I remember reading. So I think about, I don't know if you remember, but so you wrote a very pessimistic book about the size of government, right? And I remember taking you on and being like, come on, no, you know, like, and I was wrong. I was the one who was the wrong one in that debate. So I think about it a lot because I don't want you to be correct in assuming that we're doomed and that the kind of the only path forward is. And so in a way, I think about that. I think about your work on this a lot. And I just kind of want to think about ways that we haven't explored to kind of make you wrong. Because right now, unfortunately, you're more right than I was. Because I was, if you remember, this was
there was a libertarian moment. Yes.
It was a libertarian moment. And then it just changed. Like overnight.
Well, the perverse thing is that pessimists are the least often disappointed people.
Yeah, so see, I think about that a lot. And I also think about when I was writing a lot on vaping, I was always going back to your work on it. And I think kind of the way that you framed a debate with a Marlboro man, I thought was like the most useful kind of framework to talk about this. Because again, you're kind of like saying, okay, why is the government so anti-vaping? And in a way, what are the special interests protecting willingly or unwillingly?
Yeah.
Right. And kind of to say it's effectively protecting the cigarette industry, which is kind of weird and paternalistic approach to vaping, right? I thought was super useful.
All right. Well, all of those of you who employ me and wonder if I create any value, Vero is here to tell you that I do. Thanks so much for that. And thanks for being here. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
That concludes our first episode of How the World Works. I hope you enjoyed the show. You can watch my full interview with Veronique DeRougie on YouTube, a link to which we have included in the show notes of this podcast. We'll be back with another episode of How the World Works in September.